Greetings and welcome to Edgy Ideas, the podcast that explores what it means to live a good life and to create the good society in our disruptive age. My name is Simon Western, and I will be talking to invited guests about diverse topics, exploring social conscious and unconscious dynamics and desires. Welcome to Edgy Ideas Podcast. Today I'm delighted to have a guest, Ajit Mathur. Ajit is a professor at IIM Ahmedabad with many years of consulting experience for transformational leadership and organizational change with businesses, governments, international institutions, and nonprofit organizations. Ajit is also an affiliate life member of the Indian Psychoanalytic Society and Yoga Shikshak and Karma Sannyasin at the Bihar School of Yoga. Ajit has been the EU Tempus Professor of European Integration and Internationalization, and he teaches courses on strategy, international business, action research methodologies, mysteries in management, and he directs group relations conferences. His publications include 29 books and over 160 papers in scientific journals. Ajit, I'm very pleased to meet you. How are you?
Hi, Simon. I should say good afternoon because we are also conversing across friction of time and space today. It's a very sunny day here in Ahmedabad. Temperature is around 45 degrees Celsius. And we have a cyclone coming later in the day today. We have had a cyclone warning. So that's where I am at the moment. It's great to be able to connect with you over all this distance. I think one thing that this COVID-19 experience has done for the world is that it has certainly created an urge for people across the world to connect in a way that people have not connected before.
That's right. And we're really, really interested in your perspectives on what's going on. As we discussed before this went live, Ajit, it'd be very good to draw on your deeper wisdom and experience of what's going on around leadership and what kind of new leadership is required. As you know, this podcast focuses on what it means to live a good life and to create the good society. So I'm going to open and just ask you to reflect on that question.
Simon, that's probably the most important question for anyone in life at any time in civilization, how to live a good life. And I think that everyone, leaders included, have needed now to look at whether living a good life is about how much you can consume and how many experiences you can have to enhance your joys in life, or look at the discharge of responsibilities and how authority is to be exercised to do what ought to be done, because the challenges that have been thrown up by the COVID pandemic then push us in these two different directions, because there would be people who feel that, oh my goodness, what's happened to my good life? I'm not able to engage in the kind of consumption of life or in the experiences that I like to have. Maybe my holidays are affected, my travel is affected, meeting people I want to meet is affected. The other part is that, am I able to do what ought to be done? And I think we also have had to look at what about our responsibilities to our families, friends, communities, colleagues, and to the larger world. So I think both of these, in a way, present the paradox of what it is to live a good life. And leaders themselves have been constrained to struggle between the two, because any lockdown or any staying in that has been forced on a lot of people all over the world is, of course, in a way, a direct attack on one's liberties and the capacity to live one's terms in a way that we were used to. But it's also the question of what leaders are having to do, which requires to be done because of responsibilities not only to public health, but also to take cognizance of all those issues that have been festering in the unconscious and which we have actually somehow never seen or never noticed because until they got illuminated as carbuncles due to the COVID, it's not been necessary to even acknowledge that there's a requirement of taking responsibility for some of these residues and flashpoints that have been lying around for a long time. So I think the critical issue is that this has caused leadership to look back in time and have to struggle with regresses of a very unusual kind.
Yes.
It's almost of a kind that supposing we were hit by a meteor which would have had a planetary-wide impact, or if we were to be visited by a intelligent alien species, what might happen is that the whole world then wakes up to a common problem in a way that has never happened before. So I think this COVID-19 pandemic has been a bit like that because it's gone around the world in less than 80 days.
Yeah, yeah.
And something that Jules Verne would not have even imagined in his wildest imaginations when he wrote in 1872 that famous novel, Around the World in 80 Days.
Yes, yes. I haven't thought of that connection. I agree, Ajit. I think it's a great amplifier and it's a shock to the system. And listening to you, I was reminded of Sigmund Freud's late book, Civilization and Its Discontents, with that, with the individual striving for their kind of instinctual pleasures and society demanding something different and the tension that creates.
I find it very interesting, Simon, that you have come up with an association with the Freud Civilization and Its Discontents. I don't know whether you remember that this book has a history that's connected to India.
I didn't know that. Tell me.
Roman Roland was living in Calcutta at the time, and he had written a letter to Freud, sharing with him his experiences of spirituality in India, especially of meeting Ramana Maharishi and of meeting Ramakrishna and others. And he had talked about his spiritual experiences of experiencing something so large and so grand and so infinite that it changed his way of experiencing consciousness. So, and Roman Roland wrote this. He asked Freud that, have you not experienced such a state of consciousness which makes you wonder about the totality and the infinity of the universe? Mm-hmm. Have you not had this kind of a great experience or a grand experience? And Freud didn't reply to that letter for a long time. And then he wrote this. And then he said that this is my answer to Roman Roland, Civilization and Its Discontents.
Very interesting. And of course, he refers to that oceanic feeling, doesn't he?
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
That oceanic feeling was what Freud admitted that he had never experienced.
That's right.
But that oceanic feeling, which Roman Roland had shared with him, caused him to accept that it is possible that some people can experience it.
Yeah.
Of course, what is also true is that one can experience a false oceanic feeling. When you can experience an oceanic feeling that has deep stirrings in spirituality, but you can also experience this as a part of the basic assumption oneness,
yes,
which Turke has drawn our attention to, that we can also actually engage in non-task behavior and retreat and regress by imagining that we are all one when there are so many fragmentations and so many compartments that the society is made up of. I mean, look at what's happening in America, for example, that one of the profound collisions that we are experiencing in our times for leadership is the contradiction between the commitment or the ideal that we have imagined that we are living with, like liberty, equality, rule of law, democracy, capitalism, markets. But at the same time, we are now confronted with the reality that, yes, we knew that our liberty was actually one of the largest racially structured mass incarcerations of any society in the world. And we haven't done much to redress that.
No.
Equality in America is also about racial hierarchy, especially for African Americans.
That's right.
To really look at the how the story of the rule of law goes hand in hand with a deeply violent society, where law is being used as an instrument to dominate over particular groups. And I think this has come alive not only in America, but also in other places. We've also had our share of riots in India over migrant workers and over those who suddenly we discovered that we had never realized that they exist. As you know, in India, there are more than 125 million displaced people in different parts of the country. And some of 25 million of them happen to be migrant workers.
Yes.
And when COVID forced a situation where the government declared a lockdown at 3 hours notice, the leadership was blind. Leadership was completely blind that there are 25 million people who cannot reach their homes in 3 hours.
Yeah.
They're thousands of kilometers away. And their places of work where they are, the moment you have a lockdown, they'll be thrown out of work. So they won't have any means to live either. And if they won't have means to live and they can't get home, then what are you going to have? You'll have hungry people who are either going to start walking home, which a lot of people did do. A lot of people died on the way because you can't walk thousands of kilometers home when there are no buses, no trains, no means of transport, and the police is hunting you because of the lockdown. So, it has shown up the leadership in a most uncaring way in many countries. And I would say that uncaring can be of two kinds. One is that the kind of uncaring seen in Brazil and USA, where the head of state says that, no, nothing to worry. Everything will be all right. And one day this is going to disappear. And then you have the draconian measures like in India, and perhaps India had the most draconian measures, where we had curfews and we had complete lockdowns with not even supply chains functioning and no possibility even to buy fruits and vegetables.
Yeah. I'm very interested in the dynamic between social cohesion and social coercion. There's been both been playing out together in this COVID. I wonder what your experience is in India of kind of the people pulling together, a lot of mutual aid happening, a lot of support systems kind of kicking in, but also this kind of prohibition, this lockdown, and a very sharp kind of coercive impact. How's that playing out for through your observations in India?
Well, let me give you a few examples. One of the most congested, populated localities in the world is a slum called Dharavi in Bombay, where you have close to 1.5 million people living in a rather small area with common facilities of habitation, including toilets. Now, when this pandemic broke, at one level, the government does not want people to be spreading out for fear that they will have infection. Whereas actually the funny part is that for the first 20 days, all the infections that were found in the country came from abroad. They didn't come from the slum dwellers. They didn't come from the migrant workers. But somehow we were very unconsciously to project our fears onto the most vulnerable sections of society, where and we could act out social coercion by confining them in what we call containment zones.
Yeah,
I believe that this dynamic of containment is what has created another peculiar corollary, which is that boundaries of countries, which had been quietly lying low, even as disputes, even where there were some differences of opinion with neighbors, they have suddenly come alive again. So at one level, you're dealing with containment. At another level, you're dealing with complete uncontained disputes now. We have, for example, India's dispute with China, with Nepal, with Pakistan. The boundary disputes have become suddenly very alive. And as we speak, you and I, today, the generals of the Chinese and Indian armies are having a dialogue to see if they can resolve the border dispute.
Yeah.
And Nepal is just 2 days ago moved its parliament to try and get a new map approved, which would confirm the Treaty of Sigoli, It goes back to the 19th century when the British made a treaty with Nepal, according to which there are certain areas like Lipulekh, where India has built a road recently, which are considered to be part of Nepal. So I think what is also happening is that the leadership in trying to be socially coercive is also having to cope with a much larger dynamic, which is beyond the containment levels of even nations.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think it's absolutely fascinating, and what it is amplifying is this COVID. Pre-COVID, we saw kind of nationalism and populism arising in the East and the West. And as you say, this kind of question of borders and boundaries, should we kind of close our borders? Should we kind of be more global? Should we be less global? It's really impacting everywhere. Even in Denmark and Sweden, Sweden is being closed off from Norway and Denmark for the first time because of a different policy. So these questions of kind of borders and inward looking, outward looking, how we protect ourselves, how we work together to solve our challenges, are very alive, aren't they?
Absolutely. I was speaking to a friend of mine who had worked with me in the UN system, who lives in Sweden and who is a Swede. He was telling me that he was amazed that for the first time in decades, the border between Sweden and Finland had become a kind of a border where one could not cross because Finland had a very strong lockdown policy, which Sweden did not.
Yes.
And it has actually made history go back to 1917 in some ways, because that's the route Lenin took.
Yes.
And he traveled from the north of Switzerland through Germany and through Sweden to Haparanta, crossed over to Tornio, came to Tampere, and then from Tampere reached what is today St. Petersburg, where the revolution seeds were sown. So I think that we just don't know in which parts of the world we are going back and regressing how much. I even think that some of the regression has to do also with partition in India. For example, the UK left some shadows behind when it retreated after Indian independence. So in a way, if you look at what was left behind in the Indian subcontinent, and some of that has come alive, the India is the shadow of England.
Uh-huh.
Pakistan, in a way, the shadow of Scotland. And Ireland, shadow is in Sri Lanka, because Sri Lanka even had a northern Sri Lanka problem, just like the Northern Ireland problem. And Wales is like Bengal, where you had even the Welsh have always felt they are a nation. So have the Bengalis, but they were not consulted. There was no referendum. The partition took place. So people are even now questioning that, you know, when whole empires have left their shadows behind, whether it's the Russian Empire or whether it's the British Empire or whether it's any other, these shadows are now beginning to peep out of where they have been. And I think one of the challenges that leaders are facing globally is that they are having to strike a balance between three kinds of care. And I call this a trilemma, because there is health care, there is wealth care, and then there is stealth care. So what is also happening is that the authority and power of governance in stealth care.
The healthcare, wealth care, and your third one was?
Stealth care.
Stealth.
S-T-A-L-T-H. Stealth. Stealth care.
And what do you mean by that? I get the first
stealth two. Stealth care is one of the hallmarks of national governance. No government can govern without some degree of stealth care. Stealth care is the power and authority that a government arrogates to itself to be able to ensure that law and order prevails, that there is a secret service that is functioning, that there is a level of discourse that the government considers privileged, and there is a degree of surveillance to be able to control a monopoly of organized violence, without which you would not have any rights or liberties able to function in any territory. I mean, very few people realize that the freedoms and liberties that we enjoy are actually a corollary of first having a monopoly of organized violence in the territory, yes, without which you wouldn't have them at all. So that requires stealth care, and that stealth care is also now something that the leadership in governments is really worried about.
Yeah, I think this is absolutely fascinating. I mean, what you're referring to as well is what we know in psychoanalysis to be called the return of the repressed. And whether it's kind of racial violence erupting in the US through repressed sort of structural racism, or whether it's the colonial repressions coming to the surface. Until these issues are addressed, then this repetition of violence and struggle will always happen, won't it?
Well, this also means that the global leaders, and I'm now talking about government, public leaders who are elected, especially, but also those who are not elected but happen to control governments, they have to make a choice between what is sacrosanct for maintaining a monopoly of organized violence to be able to have some semblance of justice systems and rights and freedoms functioning. And yeah, the other is the reform agenda, at what you call the response of the repressed, who are now coming out and saying, all right, we've waited so patiently for so long. Maybe this is the time that we collect all our grievances and heap them. And it's a good way of heaping them if you can find a trigger.
Yes.
Now, this happening in Minneapolis is a trigger. I mean, otherwise, we have never had a situation where one person being affected would suddenly bring out a whole country on the streets.
Sure, sure. Looking at a bigger picture, Ajit, in your wide experience, you have a vast experience, and you worked in the UN and international bodies in the public and the private sectors and non-profit sectors. What do you see as a way forward? Do you see, I mean, there's no clear kind of solutions, but what kind of direction do you see leadership and governments going in to come out of this in a more progressive way than a regressive one?
Well, I think, Simon, that's a great question. I'm not sure I have all the answers, but I do have some questions which I will raise with you, and we can perhaps converse around those. Because one of the problems with the current situation is that no one has experienced this kind of phenomena at any time. So nobody living has any monopoly of the truth or even a way of confirming that person may have a magic potion that may actually give us a solution. So since nobody has the truth and nobody has any magic potions, who shall survive and under what conditions will civilization go forward? It's itself an open question.
Yeah.
Related to that, I would raise three fundamental issues. One is that pandemic crisis has caused us to reflect on a certain kind of loss of humanity. And this kind of a loss of humanity is quite unique because it's very different from warfare. In fact, I think that this whole metaphor about the war on corona is a wrong kind of metaphor because what we are dealing with is a virus, which is also a part of nature, and we are part of nature. What is this war on corona? Are we stepping outside nature to be able to fight the coronavirus? It's an impossibility.
I agree.
The discovery of humanity, the loss of humanity, and the stigma associated with the loss of humanity, which is often being pushed into others, these are some of the deepest issues that are causing a lot of fear, a lot of anger, a lot of disgust, and a lot of sadness.
Yes.
Because we don't know who shall survive and under what conditions people will survive. And in order that we engage with that, it's so very essential to look at the difference between safety and security.
Yeah.
Difference between locality and community. Difference between containment and concern or empathy, those who are being contained.
Yes.
And there is, of course, the third point that I'd like to stress in relation to this is that it brings out the importance of attending to very old concept that's been around from the time of Sophocles, and I'm referring to the concept of dignity.
Yes.
Yeah. Dignity has always been a function of something that is self-regarding, as well as something that is other regarding.
That's right.
And this crisis has forced us to really look at these dichotomies between self-respect and shame, honor and humiliation, decorum and inappropriate behavior, privacy and exposure, power and vulnerability, equality and favoritism, adulthood and infantilization, ego integrity and despair, individuation and objectification, autonomy and dependency. So when we have so many dichotomies which are attacking the very concept of dignity, because what would remain if human dignity doesn't remain? And if we compromise on human dignity, what would we be left with in terms of the kind of life that people would even want to make arrangements for? Because at this time, let's not be blind to the idea that all arrangements in the world are up for grabs.
Yes, yeah.
And if all arrangements are up for grabs and people are not even sure of who shall survive, I'm reminded of what Erikson once said. He said that children will only be able to engage with life without fear if their elders have the integrity not to fear death.
Yeah.
If we have come into a situation where we're no longer able to look at the difference between frailty and spirit, I think it's in a way we are going back to a time where respect for worth of people is itself being compromised.
I think what you're saying is very important, Ajit. This loss of humanity, this dignity. In the UK, where I'm from, I live in Ireland now, but in the UK where I'm from, there have been so many deaths in care homes, old people's homes. And these people are the voiceless. They're the people who don't have a powerful voice in society. And all the finances and resources went to kind of hospitals, but they didn't go to the elderly care homes. And I think it's about a third of the deaths took place in the care homes. And it's this absolute loss of humanity, this kind of loss of dignity, which happened. And again, in the US with the loss of dignity around the race riots and black rights, and it's not a one-off, this was a trigger, but it's really very, very clear that these things are very connected. As you know, I write on eco-leadership, the idea of ecosystems and how these things are all connected. And how you could reflect on that, this connection that you can't have one part of society being treated without humanity, without it impacting on the whole.
I think it's also made us question many illusions. For example, one of the illusions that has been around is that old age homes are communities. The reality is that as we progress towards old age, in old age, no religion anywhere in the world provides you a recipe for what can community offer you or what can you offer the community. You will not be able to show me a single faith anywhere around the world that has an answer to the question of what is a person as the person ages and approaches higher and higher ages in the march towards death. What is the role of the individual? Is there a role that even the community can play for spirituality? You'd be amazed that even the major religions do not talk about community towards the end life stages, and they talk about the individual only. They don't talk about what community the old can experience. Related to that is the question of the narcissistic injury. Narcissistic injury that is being suffered around the world to people of all classes, because they're now dealing with narcissistic injuries on a scale we have not experienced for a long, long time.
Yes.
Especially in those occupations where the occupational status was high, because these occupations like judges, professors, scientists have been interpreting the world to the uninitiated.
Yes.
Now, it is people who have been interpreting the world to the uninitiated who have to now pause and reflect and admit that we don't know. Economists have to admit but we don't know what's going to happen to the economy. Nobody has ever seen a situation where the growth rate of the economy is negative and the interest rate is zero or negative.
Yeah.
We also haven't seen a situation where claims grievances or differences or disputes and demands can be fairly dealt with if what our conception of justice or restorative justice could be when there are narcissistic injuries to class. So the judges are also in a quandary, and they don't know how to interpret when, by the way, not only judges of courts, what about the doctors and nurses who have to make judgment calls every day when they're short of beds or short of ventilators or short of ICU beds? And you have patients, old and young, rich and poor, who are all be needing for attention and can be offered. So we are reaching a situation where the wildest raw instincts of animal behavior are coming out.
Yeah.
And I'm afraid that we have to live with that, and we have to live with, in a sense, with the kind of hopelessness that I wrote about in a paper called Future, Whose Future? Dilemma of the Gandhian Eskimo, which was published in the journal Futures in 2007. And that was written specifically to deal with or to raise the thought that, okay, when situations appear completely hopeless at any point in time, can we live with the false hope that some solution will arise, or do we also have to worry about how to muster the courage to cope with that hopelessness? And that's why that paper that I wrote in Futures deals specifically with this kind of civilization and hopelessness. I circulated it on the ISPSO.
I read that paper. That was very, very helpful. Ajit, this has been a fascinating discussion, and I could go on for a long, long time, but we need to come to an end. Thank you very much. Do you have any final thoughts on living a good life and creating a good society to share with our listeners?
I think the most important unresolved question of our times, and also of the times before us, has been the question of how do we resolve conflicts that involve us versus them?
Yes.
And a lot of people, including Yuval, who has written fascinating books, at the beginning of this COVID pandemic, gave interviews in the media, and you can go back to them and listen to them. He felt that this kind of a pandemic will bring people together and will help us resolve the us versus them. I was not so optimistic then, and I'm not so optimistic now either. I see more fragmentation, and I see more division. I also see more evil, and I also see more pathology. Often the difficult part is of being able to distinguish between what is pathology and what is evil. But I think that's something we also ought to reflect on.
Yeah, that's very helpful. I agree with you. I don't take a utopian kind of view of this, but I do think our engagement with humanity and our engagement with dignity, which you pointed to, are at the heart of this struggle. And I think all of us have a individual and social responsibility to engage in that struggle to try and regain some dignity and humanity, and we look to some leadership for that. So, Ajit, your leadership has been wonderful. Thank you very, very much for joining me. I hope you enjoyed the conversation.
Thank you very much, Simon. It's been wonderful talking with you, and I look forward to continuing this conversation at some point further.
Precisely. I'll invite you back. It's been wonderful. We've got much more to talk about. Thank you, Ajit. Goodbye, and thank you all for listening. Thank you for listening to Edgy Ideas. If you enjoyed our podcast and would like more information about our coaching, training, and events, please contact simon@analyticnetwork.com or go to www.analyticnetwork.com. Thank you for listening.